Hey everyone, Tom here, along with our usual announcement of merch and posters and cool stuff being available on our shop, that's beneathskinshop.com. Also, since this is an unlocked episode, have a cool announcement that on Sunday, the 21st of April, so that's a little over a week from now, we will be hosting our first ever live show. We kept this under wraps until quite close to the show, just because tickets are super limited. We're going to be talking about some early 20th century Japanese tattoo flash tattoos, some interesting stuff. So if you're a tattoo artist, there's going to be some cool stuff that you'll get to see there. Check it out. Tickets, like I said, are super limited, and we're doing this in conjunction with Leather Lane Tattooing in Holborn. So if you want to come along next Sunday, it's at 3 p.m. at Leather Lane Tattoo. All the details are on Eventbrite, and the link is in the description. Anyway, hope you enjoyed this episode, and talk to you soon.
Tom, would you download a car?
If I could, I would.
If you could, you would. Would you download a handbag?
Yeah, 100%. Like, I think piracy is not only a ethically good thing, but is important for the preservation of history. The only thing you should not pirate is this show. Please pay for it.
the only bad piracy is the piracy that personally affects your and my pocket money income that we get from this show.
Yeah, exactly. And you're very welcome to Beneath the Skin, the show about the history of everything told through the history of tattooing. I am one of your co-hosts, Thomas O'Mahony, and I'm joined by my esteemed co-host, Dr. Matt Lauder.
Hello. Matt,
did you get your teeth whitened?
No.
They're very sparkly today. He has good teeth and a good hairline. I fucking hate this man.
Well, the hairline, I can take no credit for. The good teeth is a very, very, very long and extensive set of care by the wonderful dental surgeons and people at Guy's Hospital who rebuilt my face.
Shout out to orthodontics. That's all I gotta say.
Orthodontics, maxillofacial surgeons, all kinds of people. Yeah, this is all body mod, mate.
Yeah. You went so BME hard that and BME extreme that you just rebuilt your face.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But you can probably see from the title, if I haven't made some like weird esoteric title for this episode, we are talking about something that is kind of like has been floating around in tattooing in the past couple of years. There's been a couple of stories around it, but one most recently that came to a decision is the case about Kat Von D and, you know, who owns the legal rights to an image. So Matt, do you want to introduce our incredible guest? I did 1 year of media law as part of my media production management course. I think I got an A in it, but that was purely out of luck. I wasn't very good at it. I'm just good at arguing. So Matt, would you like to introduce our guest?
Yeah, so this is a topic I've been interested in for a very long time. There's some stuff about it in my PhD and some bits about it, but I am not in any way an expert, so it's really good to have an expert in copyright law. So joining us today is Dr. Melanie Stockton-Brown, Principal Academic in Law and member of the Centre for Intellectual Property and Policy Management at the University of Bournemouth. And she has written recently on tattoo copyright and, yeah, knows a lot more about copyright law than I do. Although I am currently starting a law degree. So come back to me in a few years and I might have more expert opinion. But I can talk about the tattoo stuff. But yeah, Melanie, welcome to the show.
Thank you both for having me. I'm really excited to be on this. And I'm very excited to hear that we have people that are actually interested in the law. Tom, I will be testing that knowledge of media law.
It was a 3-hour open book exam. It was 100% of our grade. So, you know,
that probably more or less qualifies you to be a front bench Tory MP these days.
Listen, if you want to talk about discharge of contract, force majeure, terms and conditions, I'm all yours.
Copyright. This is my love language. I love it. I love all of this.
So I suppose, Matt, do you want to give a brief introduction to this specific case? And then Melanie, do you want to explain kind of the intricacies and differences? Because there's a lot of phrases thrown around ownership, authorship, copyright, differences between copyright, trademark, and IP. So Matt, do you want to go first?
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty good way to do it. We'll talk about the case that's most sort of immediate in the news, and then when we can kind of rewind. But yeah, the real question that sort of prompted us to do this episode was a case that was decided in the US a couple of weeks ago, where Kat Von D, sort of celebrity tattooer, who works in kind of this black and grey sort of photorealistic style, had tattooed a copy of a photograph of the jazz trumpeter Miles Davis, and that had been taken in 1989 by a photographer called Jeffrey Sedlick. And Sedlick saw on Kat Von D's Instagram a couple of years ago now that she'd done this tattoo, and figured that this was infringing on his intellectual property, that it was kind of copyright infringement. And so he took her to court. And actually, this issue, I guess we'll talk about, is something that's been really something that's been live in copyright law discussions, at least for about 30 years. But this felt like almost the last piece of the puzzle. So yeah, I don't know, Melanie, what do you make of it?
Yeah, it's a really interesting case. I've been following it both as obviously a copyright lawyer, but also as a tattooed person, and knowing that this is something that, as you say, Matt, the tattoo industry is kind of getting increasingly kind of concerned with, and there's a lot of different views around this. I imagine some of your listeners might even be thinking, you know, we don't want copyright law or law in tattooing at all. You know, this is just going to ruin it. We don't need this. There are some people that think this needs to be regulated. It needs to protect people, you know, for business. And then I think there's a lot of us, including me, that kind of sit somewhere in the middle. It's not helped by the fact that the laws around this are an absolute mess.
Yeah.
None of it is clear. So that is not that you guys don't understand this because you're not lawyers. Trust me, the more you learn, and Matt, you'll find this in your law degree, you'll realize that the law is just a patchwork of bad decisions and old laws and, you know, things that seemed a good idea at the time and didn't foresee the advance of a new technology. So I guess I'm trying to think of the best way to start with this. Might be to just to give a really kind of brief breakdown of what we actually mean when we talk about copyright law and what some of these words mean.
Yeah. And of course, we're also talking about here like US copyright law in this specific case, but which has lots of international applicability through treaty as well. So there's also these weird kind of local jurisdictional intersections, which make it even more complicated as well with EU,
absolutely,
with World Intellectual Property Organization, all this stuff. So it's very, very complicated, as you said.
It's very complicated. I mean, luckily so, otherwise I'd be out of a job. So let's not try and demystify it too much, or people will realize they don't need us lawyers. So the best place to start is, what's intellectual property trying to do? And what it's trying to do is to protect creative products. And it's all about encouraging creativity through economic gain. So the idea of copyright is you can afford to be an artist or a novelist or a musician because you can spend time creating these beautiful, wonderful things. And then you have this right known as copyright, which means that you can stop somebody else using your work without your permission. And the idea behind that is, if you want to use it or someone else wants to use it, they have to pay you some money. So when you buy a book in a shop, the money you're paying is partly to pay for all of the various publishing and printing costs, but a little bit of that goes to the author for copyright.
A very little bit, I can attest.
A very little bit, yeah. It's when you see the contracts for things like this, it's way smaller than you might imagine, Matt. I'm sure you've been on the receiving end of that. And you kind of, you see the price on the back of your book and think, that's not the amount hitting my bank account. What's gone wrong here?
And so, for example, for anyone listening, Beneath the Skin as a creative work is copyrighted to both me and Matt.
Yeah, absolutely. And copyright lasts a long time these days. So, you know, it lasts your full lifetime and then 70 years after your death. So that's something that, you know, when we think about everything we're making today through your whole lifetime and through, you know, if you have like kids or grandkids, that they own that as well. So we're talking about something that is a huge commercially kind of valuable. So you mentioned before, Tom, about the difference between copyright and trademark. It's a great question. It's one I get asked all the time by my law students as well. So essentially, trademark is to distinguish brands. So if you have a logo or you have a slogan, it's something that you can look at that image or that word and recognize the brand. So it's for consumers. So, okay, I've got a bar of dairy milk here. If I was to hold that up and show you guys, you would know that's the Cadbury's logo. You know, so when you spend your money, you know what you're getting. Copyright is basically for creative and artistic works. So music, books, artworks, sculptures, computer games, video games, fashion, anything like that. So copyright is the kind of the one that applies to the world of tattooing.
So, for example, a couple of years ago, the creative work of Sherlock Holmes entered the, you know, common ownership. I can't remember the exact term.
Yeah.
But public domain. But the characters, individuals in the stories are owned separately by loads of different families because he didn't leave it directly to people. So that's how we have a situation where something like Steamboat Willie is now in the Creative Commons, but Mickey Mouse himself is still owned by Disney.
Yeah, so this public domain, this is where the kind of public space where copyright no longer exists. So you don't have to pay anyone or get any permission. So kind of just a fun fact, copyright, so the 1st of January every year is Public Domain Day. So it's when things that are this life plus 70 years, when that comes to an end, every 1st of January, a whole load of things come into the public domain. So we saw this 2 or 3 years ago with The Great Gatsby. So as soon as something enters the public domain, the number of kind of adaptations and spin-offs and reworkings that appear just goes through the roof because now you don't have to pay anyone. So it's this huge boom of creativity. But yeah, as you say, Tom, it can get very complicated because big brands like Disney, for example, they're very good at protecting their IP and they're very good at saying, well, these episodes or this character is now in the public domain, but this slightly different adapted character of Mickey still in copyright. And that's kind of how these monopolies of control continue.
Yeah, and so, and that's interesting, that phrase monopolies of control, because it's not just about paying, it's also about getting permission, right? So if you own the copyright in a work, you have complete veto, but more or less, with some small exceptions, over what other people can do.
Absolutely.
To reuse or engage with your creative work in their own creative work to kind of,
So copyright law, when it was originally kind of set out in 1710 as the first kind of copyright act in this country, and it was all related to book publishing, and it was never imagined to kind of span the way it does now. But as you say, Matt, you know, you could be the world's most beautiful artist and you could do all these amazing paintings, and you could decide to sell them to no one, to show them to no one, to give no one permission to use them. And that would be your right as the artist to decide to do that. The difficulty gets when things kind of either certain characters or certain symbols enter this kind of public consciousness of, you know, the shared heritage of there are some things that we all recognize and respond to. And therefore we feel, well, we're just responding to that creatively. But you've got a private entity that's saying, oh, no, we control that. And this is where kind of popular culture in particular really struggles with copyright law.
Mm-hmm. So then I suppose diving into this case, can you kind of explain where the legal argument is here?
Yes, absolutely. So The case is interesting, and then in the middle, there's an Andy Warhol decision that blows it wide open. So basically, it's very much a tale of two halves. So when Kat Von D tattooed this image of Miles Davis onto her friend, as Matt said, she used Jeffrey Sedlick's, you know, really beautiful photograph as the reference image. And there's been no dispute the whole way through. That's the photograph she was drawing from. It's clearly that one. And she even put Instagram posts online, you know, kind of showing the reference image and the final product, you know, to show how skilled she is, because it's a beautiful tattoo. So Sedlick's argument is that she's infringing his copyright in his photograph, because it's in copyright because he's still alive. So we don't have to worry about, it's called copyright duration. We know the photographer's still alive, so it's still in this life plus 70. And he's saying Kat Von D didn't ask my permission and she didn't pay any money or get a license to use my photograph. So he's saying that's copyright infringement. Her argument for most of this litigation, because it's gone on for 2-3 years, I think more like 3 years before it's finally kind of come to a bit of a decision last month, was that she was saying it was transformative and it was fair use. Now, I imagine that's a term you've both heard before, this idea of fair use. Yeah. It's quite a difficult one to explain. And for people listening, the American idea of fair use, and that's why, as Matt was saying before, it's really important to know that this is an American case, because the law in each country is a bit different. And the law we have here is not the same as over there. So in America, they have fair use, which was, well, up until very recently, certainly so, much broader than what we have here. It's this idea to say, yes, we have copyright. Yes, the people that own copyright can control things, but they can't stop the public being inspired by it. They can't stop parody. They can't stop you using a photo of a film poster as part of a film review. They can't stop you doing live reporting or anything like that.
I don't know if you know, Tom, one of the real inspirational cases for the fair use doctrine was it Naughty by Nature, like this parody rap song back in the 80s and 90s. So we have kind of like rude hip hop who really set out some of the landmarks in fair use doctrine, right?
Yeah, so we have to thank Two Live Crew.
It's
fair use is what protects our Instagram from me getting sued into the ground by British Pathé, because, yeah, you know, it is reporting and a transformative work. But on that term, a transformative work, can you kind of dig into that? Because that's, from my experience, that's something that's quite difficult to navigate in a legal sense of what is truly transformative or what is representative.
Massively. So this idea of transformative use, up until at least the Andy Warhol case at the end of last year, was this idea that you were adding something new. So it was a new meaning or expression or a new kind of way of using this thing. And as you say, this is where we get kind of people reworking things, parodying, homage, tribute, kind of putting your spin on things. In America, much broader than here. So in America, the basic good rule of thumb was if you weren't doing it for clear commerce, so if you weren't getting clear money for it, and you were crediting the original work in some way or not trying to pass it off as your own, it was basically seen as that will be fair use. Okay. What we have in the UK is something called fair dealing, which is much smaller. So in this country, depending on whether you're, which side of the table you sit on, you know, you might feel that's a good or a bad thing, but it's a lot harder in this country to do it. So America do actually have a definition of fair use in their law, section 107 of the Copyright Act, if anyone's interested. Our government hasn't decided that's necessary, so they've decided not to give a clear definition. But even when we're looking at things like fair use, it still needs to be done case by case. And that, I think, is something that is, whether you're a tattoo artist, whether you're an author, whether you're a musician, whether you're running an amazing podcast, you know, it's, that gets incredibly frustrating, because you were like, there should be a rule. We have this rule that's often cited, like you can take 10% of something. that's not a real law. That's not something that exists in law. But, you know, the public say, well, we need to have a test of knowing when are you stealing something and when are you not. I'm happy to talk through the kind of fair use breakdown if that's helpful, but I don't want to bore anyone level.
I wonder if, like, yeah, what you make of the decision here. So,
actually, Matt, before we go into the decision, can you talk a little bit about the arguments that both sides made?
Yeah. Kat Von D is arguing, or initially for most of it, is arguing that it's transformative. So she's saying, he's done this photograph, it's beautiful. I have taken that and I've put it onto a living body. So obviously the skill and work of translating a kind of static image onto skin. She also talked about how she'd given it kind of watercolor feeling, that she'd added like movement to the hair and the edges of the kind of image. And it's that translation and that reinterpretation onto his body that she's saying that's different. It's for a completely different purpose as well. And that's quite important. So when you're looking at copyright infringement, you're looking at what was the purpose of the work. So she didn't charge her friend for this tattoo. So this wasn't to make money. She was saying this was a gift. This was a tribute piece of work, which is completely different to a photograph taken, as Matt said, to go onto the front cover of a magazine in 1989. So that's what she's going along with. Sedlick has some pretty good arguments against that. So his first one is, you didn't charge your friend for the tattoo, but you shared these posts on your social media. And, you know, of both her private one and of her studio, which was still open at the time, but has since closed. And, you know, these had substantial social media followings. And he's saying everything you're doing and sharing on there is promoting you and your business. Therefore, it is commercial. And, you know, that's quite an important point to make, because a lot of copyright cases around this, and linking it back to kind of what this means for tattooists and people that have tattoos, this aspect of commerciality, that's an important point to pick up on.
Mm-hmm. So Bob Weir, if you're listening, please do not sue us for the last t-shirt we made. Jerry Garcia's dead. He can't do anything, but you can, Bob. So that argument kind of that went back and forth. It seemed to really, the transformative nature of the tattoo, which can be argued because of the, you know, artistic expression of it, the argument seemed to really hinge on the fact that, and the decision that, she didn't get any money for it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a key point in this. And it's actually, I was kind of reading up on this case again ahead of coming on here. And I read that Sedlick had actually had someone use one of his images before as a tattoo of Miles Davis. And he'd contacted the tattoo artist, but this particular one had only like 3 followers on his Instagram. So basically in that case, he'd given that artist a kind of retrospective license, as he called it, and almost said, okay, yes, that was my image. I wish you'd asked my permission, but you're clearly like, you know, you're just establishing, it's like a small thing. But for him, it was Kat Von D's status and I think reach on social media that really differentiated it for him. And I guess the aspect of this is essentially he's saying she could have afforded to ever pay me or at least ask my permission. Whereas someone that's kind of not in that celebrity eye, he wouldn't have taken the same view with.
I mean, straightforwardly, right? And this is where this gets really interesting. Is that if someone had taken that photograph and painted a copy of it onto a mug or a poster or a tea towel or any medium other than the human skin, quite straightforward. I mean, maybe I'm overstating, but it feels like that's a much more obvious case of infringement, right? And for a long time, I mean, my friend Marissa Kakulis, who's an amazing tattooed lawyer in New York, has been writing about this stuff for years as well, and she wrote about some of these other cases we'll get onto in a second years and years ago. And I think for a long time the law journal work on this, because what there's been a lot of discussion about this stuff in academic terms, but not really a lot of decision, because the few cases that have been brought were often settled out of court, and they were settled out of court because the general consensus was that copyright law, really by a sort of plain reading of it does apply quite straightforwardly to tattooing. If you treat tattooing as the same kind of practice as painting or drawing or printing or etching or photocopying, because any other medium than the human skin, this would be a much, this would be a quite straightforward win for Sedlick, almost certainly. I mean, it's a bit more complicated than that, obviously, at the edges. I guess maybe we'll talk about that Warhol case. But like the sense among lawyers for a long time, as or legal theorists at least for a long time, has been, tattooists shouldn't be copying other people's designs, because technically it is. And then whether it should be or not is another question. I mean, this is something that I wrote about in my PhD thesis a long time ago. But is that right to say, Melanie, that from, if this was any other medium that Von D was working in, this would have been a much more straightforward case for Sedlick to win?
Yeah, I think absolutely. And this is where I feel really conflicted as a tattooed person, because as you say, if we were talking about a painting or a t-shirt or a mug or anything like that, this would have been infringement. And it would have been really blatant infringement that I cannot see would have had this back and forth over several years. It would have been a lot easier to decide. And I think it actually links almost to quite an interesting idea of almost, what are tattoos and what do they mean to our society? Yeah. And I know, obviously, Matt, that's something that you've done a huge amount of work on, is this kind of, is it art? If it's on the body, do rules apply differently? Do we want them to apply differently?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that I think, and this is something that obviously artists have been interested in for a long time. I mean, it's something that, people like Richard Prince and Sherry Levine have been interested in, like artists who work in this mode that we art historians call appropriation art, where actually you do copy things more or less exactly. And the questions that poses artistically, are these questions we're asking now. What do we want culture to be? What does creativity mean? I mean, it's the question. I love this. I realized that she's cited on this quote of mine, is cited on Wikipedia, which is why it's up in my mind. It's in the Wikipedia for sailor tattoos, which was interesting to see. But Borges, the Argentinian writer, wrote this short story called Pierre Menard, author of the Quixote, about an author who he imagined copied Cervantes's Don Quixote, like word for word. And in that, Borges says, writing Don Quixote in the 17th century, or whenever it was obvious. Writing it in the 20th century is difficult, right? There's something important about context. And even if it looks the same, there's something happening artistically, affectively in the process of copying. And I think it's not difficult. It's impossible for the law to really unpick, which is why this work's super interesting, and why artists like Richard Prince in particular, Jeff Koons to some degree, Warhol, other artists.
Stop bringing up Jeff Koons on this podcast.
He's been sued for doing this kind of thing as well, right? For copying. And actually, I think there's something affectively interesting in the process of copying. Mm-hmm. But copyright law goes against that, right? That whole idea.
And like for me, definitely from like an artistic perspective, from like say stuff that I make personally, quite often it is ripping off other people and trying to create this transformative work from stuff that already exists. But I want to ask to talk a little bit about what sort of judicial precedents does this set, but also like what does this mean for tattooing in the sense of like artists that render fairly accurate portraiture of like already existing people and already existing photographs, but also then does this kind of get rid of the idea of a kind of implied copyright for people who are creating designs? Like a lot of tattoos that I have are designs done by other people. For example, the Dan Higgs mage that I have on my shin. Can't imagine Dan Higgs is gonna kick up about the copyright of his design, but what does that represent then?
So very good question. So there's some reassurance here in that the judgment that actually came down sidesteps a lot of these conversations. So there was a Supreme Court decision in the US at the end of last year, whilst the Kat Von D case was ongoing, relating to an Andy Warhol dispute. And the kind of the facts are kind of irrelevant to this, but the main idea was this kind of idea of precedent or like legal rule that's important and handed down. And in that, they were saying that just because you add a new meaning or a new purpose to something does not inherently make it transformative. So what they were saying there was this has to be done case by case, and you have to demonstrate something beyond just it's in a new context or I've put my own spin on it. So that meant that the argument that Kat Von D had been making around this transformative fair use, when she came to the jury trial in January, that's not the argument she put forward anymore, because essentially it had been, we refer to it as kind of foreclosed. It was basically a moot point. Like, she was going to lose if she said that, so she had to try a plan B. And instead, what the jury were looking at was this, like the similarity. Basically, was this substantial similarity, similar copying? Sorry, too many S's there for me. And the jury decided that the two images were not sufficiently similar. So they've gone down that road. And they were also looking at this idea of kind of the commerciality and whether or not she'd infringe the image by sharing it on social media when she then shared the original photograph as her the reference image. And again, they decided that she hadn't. So I've read there's a number of really good like online blog posts and kind of responses to this case already, kind of from all different points of view, some from intellectual property, some from tattooing, some from like artists. And I would encourage kind of listeners to go and look at some of them if you're interested, because you get a really range of responses to this. But the overall opinion is, at least from, I would say, my point of view, is it kind of falls a bit in the middle. So some news lines, headlines were talking about this as, you know, tattoo artists, this case proves that you can tattoo what you want. You don't need to get permission. But actually this case, they were saying you have to do it case by case. So Kat Von D with this particular photo and this particular tattoo wasn't deemed to be infringing. But what they haven't done is set down a legal rule, which could have been the case, where they said any tattooist could do this. So in that sense, I feel it's almost like we were in a muddy river and now it's just a bit more muddy than before. And with now with the added confusion that some tattooists are going to take from this, oh, I'm allowed to do this, so it's fine. And some artists are potentially going to be even more wary and litigious, you know, meaning they want to try and stop you doing this. So I think if anything, it's just kind of kicked a hornet's nest. So in terms of what does this mean going forwards, very little in a legal sense for other people. And particularly in this country, it doesn't have a direct legal kind of bearing. But I think culturally, I think it's showing that these are conversations that people want to have and we need answers to. And whether you're a tattooist or a tattoo enthusiast, it doesn't benefit the industry to have no clarity on this because, you know, if we had to get copyright permissions for all of these, the industry would have to operate very, very differently and tattoo prices would go up a lot.
Hey, are you enjoying the show? If you really like Beneath the Skin and you want to help support us, you can do so on Patreon. For little as £5 a month, you can help make this show possible, help us buy research materials. So if you like the show and you want to support us, consider kicking us a few quid a month and you'll get everything from bonus episodes to Q&As, and you can even vote on what tattoo I'll get when we reach a certain subscriber count. Matt, have you got anything to say?
You should really definitely fund the Patreon because tattoo history is massive, right? Deep, wide, complicated. We're covering some big hit topics on the main feed, but on the Patreon subscriber-only feed, we'll be getting into some really more interesting, niche, deep topics you don't want to miss out on. And honestly, the chance to kind of decide what Thomas gets on his body is probably just a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Subscribe, chuck us a few quid. Don't miss out on the chance to ruin Thomas's body forever.
Well, this is sort of what I want to move on to next, in a way, because, you know, tattooing is and always has been, in a kind of professional Western sense, a kind of appropriative art form. You know, tattooers copying photographs. But for example, right, so Sutherland MacDonald, who I've written a lot about, the first Victorian tattooer, he was first, you know, big pro anyway. He was copying things from magazines and copying paintings, but he lodged the photographs of his work in the copyright library, which is where I found them a few years ago in the National Archive. So he was seeking copyright for his own. It's sort of unclear whether he was seeking copyright for the photographs. I think that's probably the most reasonable interpretation of what he was trying to do. So he clearly wanted to protect his own work, even though while him and his clients figured that taking works and tattooing them on the skin was fine. And I mean, as I said, we've had these questions for sort of at least 30 years. The first case, I think, is the Dennis Rodman case. And that's different, interestingly, from the Kat Von D case. So what we've had right recently is the Kat Von D decision. And we also had a decision last year, or maybe it might be, yeah, it was last year, Catherine Alexander's case regarding the tattoos that she'd done on WWE wrestler Randy Orton that were in reproduced in a video game. And most crucially for that case, that you could use them in the character designing screen, so that they weren't just part of his likeness, but they were also kind of her art, if you think about it in that way, were abstracted. So that's a slightly different account here of, rather than the copyright being in the original quote unquote, you know, source image that was copied onto the skin, this is copyright in the tattoo itself. And the Alexander case was the first of that kind that was also went to judgment, because other cases prior to that had been settled, right? So the other thorny question here that we also have, I don't know whether you think it's more or less clarity, because she won the case but was only awarded $3,500 in damages, which is very sort of weird Pyrrhic victory. The other question is here is, who owns the copyright of a tattoo? Is it the person on whose body it is, which seemed to be the argument that was being made, for example, in the Dennis Rodman case, who back in the 90s sued a t-shirt manufacturer who was trying to do bootlegs of the tattoos on his body, and he claimed ownership of them as the bearer. Or what's happened in the Alexander case, which went to trial, or some of the previous cases that were settled out of court, particularly a case around this basketball player Rasheed Wallace in 2004, whose tattoos were animated for a commercial. So then you've got this other question about copyright in the tattoo itself, not just in the source image, and whether it's the person who bears it, wears it, or whether it's the tattoo artist. I mean, do you feel like the Alexander case has given us more or less clarity on that side of the question?
Yeah, again, really interesting cases there as well. I think what's interesting about a lot of these is, to my mind, and some kind of thinking more from a copyright perspective, it seems to draw quite a clear distinction around who these tattoos are on. So there's this concept in law, more so in America, it's just very beginning to develop here, of like publicity rights, or the like, to kind of right to your image and likeness, okay? And where we're seeing, you know, big kind of celebrities or, you know, football or basketball players or actors, you know, people that have this really high profile and their tattoos are being represented or used, that's where we're seeing the artist say, essentially, you're getting some benefit from my work, and I would at least like to be recognized and ideally paid. And, you know, you see it with celebrities who get told by their tattoo artists, particularly for video games, you know, if you reproduce this in a video game, you know, I want you to give me at least the courtesy of permission, and usually some money. And I think really this comes down to this idea of commerciality. So I don't know if these cases that you were talking about, Matt, I don't know how much they feed down to like the average person being tattooed. I think for me, it more draws the line of almost, if you're in the kind of a more of a public eye and you're getting some benefit from this and there's money to be made. There's an interesting part of copyright, and say, do tell me if this is too boring, but, you know, we always focus about the economic side of copyright, so, you know, the right to get money. But there's a kind of aspect of moral rights, which relates to the kind of artistic part of it. And there's one about attribution, so the right to be named as the author. And it's really interesting that when I've done some research into this, and when you chat to people, often what they say is, you know, that they at least could have said it was my name. They could have credited me. And I wonder as well if how much of the time, if artists were reached out to first and said, you know, would you mind if I do this? Or conversely, if you're a tattoo artist and you're going to be tattooing you know, a living artist's work on someone, almost that kind of saying, do you mind if I do this? Do I have your permission? Almost that green light. I wonder if that would avoid a lot of the litigation, because when we have litigation, it's a failure of law and it's a failure of negotiation usually.
It's interestingly, it plays into the case of, I can't remember the exact artist, but once again, 2K Games catching strays all over the place with this representation of LeBron James in a recent NBA 2K game that, like, the artist brought the case that you were reproducing my work. I'm obviously not being credited or paid for it, but the case was dismissed based on the ruling that the tattoos didn't make up a significant enough amount of LeBron James' recognizable visage, essentially.
That was the difference in logic between the NBA 2K ruling and the WWE ruling, is that in the WWE game you could use the tattoos that Alexander had designed in the character creation screen, but you couldn't do that in the NBA version. And that was the crucial difference, I think, as I understand it.
I think another really interesting aspect of what you were saying just before, Matt, is like, who is the artist in a, yeah, like, when we make a tattoo, who is the copyright owner? If we are saying that there is one, who is that to be? And I find that really interesting because, you know, I'm imagine this might be the case for you too. I have a combination of Flash and Bespoke. And, you know, for me, my Flash tattoos, instinctively, I'm like, well, it's the tattooist. That I love this image, but I didn't feed into that in any way. Whereas I feel there's an argument more for this concept of joint authorship, which copyright does have. When you have a bespoke piece, or, you know, you see these like incredible leg or back pieces that person, the artist, have worked together and designed for years sometimes. I think both people feel that they fed into that and yeah, it was collaborative.
And this is the argument. I mean, I spend a lot of time on that exact question in my PhD thesis, because it's an argument this guy, Harkins, who was writing about the Rasheed Wallace case, this basketball player whose tattoos were animated in a Nike commercial, which was settled out of court. That was an argument he was making, Christopher Harkins, basically saying, maybe kind of joint authorship is the way to go. And I think, you know, as an art historian, this is one of the ways where I found art history as a really useful analysis set for this, because art history has a good set of differing models for collaborative authorship, one of which is actually patronage, right? That goes right the way back to the Renaissance in architectural theory. I think it was it Alberti, maybe, who said, like, the architect is the father of the building and the client is the mother, or maybe the other way around. There is this kind of joint. There's this kind of joint stake, right? And art history has a good, you know, we have models for workshop authorship and attribution in collective spaces. And one of the things that's really missing in psychological, sociological accounts of tattooing, which I think has probably been part of the cultural issue where the law's concerned too, is that the standard up until very, very recently account of who the author of a tattoo is the person on whose body it is. And of course, when we get into this stuff that we're talking about now, that's missing. And I, you know, I've been sort of banging this drum, you know, for, you know, more than a decade, nearly 15 years now, my PhD came out. And it's sort of the rubber's finally hit the road. And it's interesting some of these kind of more nuanced ways of actually thinking about what the reality of the production process actually looks like. What is the relationship between the source image, the bearer, and the practitioner? Actually, is something that art historians, at least, have been thinking about for ages.
And I think, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. And I think your work on this, and Adam McDade's work on this as well, like, you know, I think basically is really highlighting that copyright law and intellectual property, it feels like a real lack of this kind of sense. You know, it lacks a lot of these theories and development. And I completely agree with you. It's this, the concept we have in law, not just for tattoos, but in general around intellectual property, very much has this idea of one person by themselves, you know, working into the night on a project, almost in isolation from others or a community or a shared heritage from the past, generating this genius work and wishing to sell it. And that's not the reality in which creativity works. That's not the way we work. And I think art history has a lot to offer intellectual property if IP will listen in that.
I love this quote. This is from an amazing art historian up in Scotland called Jill Burke, whose work I love, works on Renaissance stuff and did a whole book about collaborative production. She said, in the Renaissance, an individual personality is seen to be somehow revealed and embodied by the objects he paid for. The actual maker of these objects is a vessel for the impulses poured into him by a patron and implicitly by the society that shaped the patron's wishes. Like, I thought that was such a good, you know, you can sort of imagine the Pope going to Michelangelo, like, make me a ceiling, you know? and you know, that definitely is something that I think is it's a model that, I mean, also it doesn't really fit. This is also the issue, as you said, the copyright law comes from the 18th century and it arises from this romantic era of the birth of the idea of an individual genius creating something of their own, you know, which again, I think we in the postmodern period realize is impossible, but that 18th century copyright law comes from this historical moment of individual genius, which rejects the idea of influence and, you know, shared cultural genesis.
And copyright has really held on to that image, as you say, yeah. You know, and you referred before, I think, to the Berne Convention, to the International Treaty on Copyright, and, you know, around the world, and again, almost, you know, here you're looking at colonialism, the Western view of intellectual property has been enforced worldwide through things like the Berne Convention. So this idea of the, as you say, romantic genius author making something by themselves, and at least historically very much a male focus as well, that's really deeply embedded into the law. And we see this have conflicts in music collaboration, in fashion, in anything that relates to kind of indigenous crafts or art forms. And I think tattooing is just another thing that some of us have been passionate about for a long time, but is only now getting that focus more. And again, it just shows actually that copyright and intellectual property, although I love them and they're my area, they're no longer fit for purpose. Yeah. They're not designed for the world we live in.
I mean, I was reminded, I was reading something the other day about the banning of tattooing under 18 in England and Wales, which happened in 1969. And that was the result of a case where there was no law against tattooing people under the age of 18. But in 1967, I think I'm right in saying sometime immediately preceding 69 anyway, there was an assault case brought on a tattooer who was tattooing a 12 and 13-year-old boys. And he was charged with and convicted of grievous bodily harm. And so the tattooers at the time, the professional kind of more salubrious end of the industry, were like, oh, tattooing is clearly illegal in some senses, but there's no law that explains what those circumstances might be. And so they were actually, although it affected tattoo business quite badly, tattooers were actually talking at the time about quite welcoming the 1969 Tattooing of Minors Act, because it actually gave them the clarity to say what is legal and what isn't legal. And I wonder if, you know, there's this, I'm sure it's not anywhere near this political agenda and won't happen, but I feel like the tattoo industry needs some clarity on this. Because as you said, everyone's still living in this gray zone, even though we've had some sort of some definitive judgments on this finally.
The way that I could see it happening, although I agree with you that I don't think it's on any priority lists at the moment for Parliament, unfortunately, is the government has got this huge push for this, like, to make the UK a creative and media industries like giant by 2030. And they're putting like billions and billions they've promised into it. And it's interesting that I very much see tattooing as one of those industries, you know, from an economic sense, it's worth a huge amount. From a kind of social and cultural sense, you know, we all know day to day how many people have tattoos now. It's something that's clearly very important to us. And law is a social construct, or that's something I drum into my students again and again. You know, we create the law. And if the law isn't working for us, then we can change it. Law doesn't exist like gravity is a natural thing that we've discovered, despite some people feel like they respond to it. So I'm like, if the law from 1710 doesn't quite fit 2024, it's okay to say that and okay to say, let's change it. Or, you know, even the Copyright Designs and Patents Act, 1988, you know, we're looking at something that is close to 40 years old, and AI, tattooing, so the internet, so many advances since then that fundamentally changed the landscape. So I do think it should be a priority for the government if they are serious about making, you know, supporting creativity and innovation in this country, to at least update copyright law and the kind of IP law in this country in general, but also to actually include tattooing clearly within the act.
Yeah, I mean, I think I don't know if that's, but I'd be interested to know what you think. One of my senses is that the upside of this very high profile set of trials in the US is going to make sure that when there are discussions, because, you know, the UK are talking about how to reincorporate European copyright law, right, post-Brexit, there's all this. So I think, like, this is going to at least make whichever civil servants are drafting these acts and treaties, like, they should be aware that this is a very interesting live issue because it was such a high-profile case. So I wonder if you think the fact that it is this super famous, you know, set of people involved in these recent cases is going to make sure it is on people's agendas when it comes to, you know, these iterations that are happening.
I think that's a really good point. Yeah, I think so. I think, and this is where law is so interesting around the soft power. Although a US case for domestic copyright law in no way touches on our copyright law in this country, I think you're right that this is now becoming so high profile, and a lot of people are kind of aware of the Mike Tyson tattoo case as well. And I think you're right. It's something that in the past would have been seen as too small or very marginal. Whereas now, I hope so. I hope that if nothing else, these cases becoming high profile puts them onto agendas, but that they actually consult tattooed people and tattooists as part of this, hopefully, as well.
And I suppose maybe as like kind of a closing question, I'm sure there's people who are listening to this who might be concerned for their own business in terms of materials that they use as references. What would you say, in a way that is totally not binding legal advice?
Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Yeah, unless it is a podcast specifically designed for people seeking legal help. What would you say to the people who might be concerned about the results of these cases?
So from a kind of reassurance point of view, I would say to these people listening, if they're kind of in the UK, that is a US case. Our law is way far behind here. We don't even have the same clarity they have over there about how tattooing is or isn't protected. So this case doesn't mean that you can or can't suddenly do something with tattooing. What I would say is to, where possible, if you are drawing from a reference image and you're sharing it, it's always a nice thing to attribute, you know, to say who made that, or to, especially if it's a tribute or a homage, you know, shout out to the person whose work you love. And I think that kind of working practice steps around a lot of this, but in a way that doesn't get in the way of the creativity. But I would say, don't let the fear ruin what we're doing in an industry that we all love and a practice that we all love. And the only people that need to really think about this in more depth are those high profile, you know, top of the industry people. The average person doesn't get sued for the simple reason that the average person...
If you're tattooing famous people,
yeah,
be extra careful.
If you're tattooing famous people, be extra careful. That probably is somewhere where you might want to speak to a kind of a intellectual property lawyer. But the average person doesn't get sued because the average person doesn't have enough money. You know, suing only works if someone has £1 million in the bank. So I would say day to day, just try and, you know, good working practices and shout out to the people whose work you're inspired by. Yeah. But I wouldn't worry about it beyond that.
I did see Henry Haight, London tattooer Henry Haight, who tattooed the famous pin-up on Amy Winehouse's arm. was posting on Instagram last week because there's a new film about Amy's life, and he's sort of a tattooer tattooing her is sort of portrayed in the film, and he was a bit salty about it because they didn't approach him, and he was just sort of griping about it publicly. But yeah, I guess, you know,
that's interesting. He could pursue that more for like publicity or likeness, yeah, or potentially defamation, because essentially they're representing him in that. So sometimes copyright's not the easiest route to take on something. But if someone is portraying you in your likeness, then publicity or image rights would have some protection there.
Yeah, and I guess maybe even things like libel and things like that as well might apply there too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can I ask a final question, which is about remedies? This is something I was interested in back in 2010 when I did my PhD. And again, I'm still not sure what the answer is. And the thing I wrote about back then was this, it was around the time when it's not quite copyright. It's a sort of related bit of intellectual property law. It was this case where someone online had found the decryption algorithm for DVDs, and had basically posted the way to like the decryption key so you could remove the copy protection, which was a crime under the American Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which makes it a crime to circumvent copyright protection measures. And so, but this key is just a number. It's a long number, but it's a number. And so people took to like posting this number in memes and posting it in, you know, and one guy got it tattooed on himself and posted it on his blog with the title "Take Down This," right? Because the company that owned the algorithm was sending takedown notices. And that got me wondering, like, and I guess it also applies in this Kat Von D case, like, what are the remedies here? Because if, for example, like the case you mentioned with Mike Tyson, was there was a sort of parody of his facial tattoo in The Hangover Part 2, and the artist who did that tattoo before the film came out like threatened a lawsuit, and there was a chance at least that film could have been prevented from being released. Books that have, and other works of art that have had copyright infringement, have been destroyed under legal advice. But I can't see what even if a tattoo was found to be in breach of copyright, how the standard remedies for copyright would apply. I mean, that's another thing that I've been thinking about for a long time, and I don't have a clear answer about. I wonder what you thought about that.
You get the cheese grater out, Matt.
So, again, this is an example of where tattooing doesn't fit within intellectual property well. So you're quite right. If I was selling, you know, copyright counterfeit DVDs, they could be taken out of circulation. If I'd made a whole load of artworks, they could be destroyed. But what do you do when it's on someone's body? And again, this is one of the reasons I think we are seeing tattoos treated differently, because even if we try and say, oh, let's view it as an artwork and treat it that way, they're on someone's body, and a person has a right to, you know, walk on the beach and show it off or put pictures of themselves online. To date, the issue has mostly been sidestepped, but I would say that this will come down to the purpose of what you're doing. So, for example, if you wanted to post pictures of yourself online, kind of, and you had like an infringing tattoo and you were getting money from those posts, or there was like sponsored, they could basically say that you can't do that, and you basically can't continue to commercialize the product. That's probably the most sensible remedy they would take. And if you've been kind of putting pictures up about it, they might ask you to take them down. But yeah, luckily, Tom, no cheese grater. But it's an area of law that there's not enough flex in the law around tattooing. And that's why they try and, kind of like in the Kat Von D case, they often try and sidestep the big issue and almost find it on a technicality and do it that way, because otherwise they have to deal with, do you say to someone they have to wear a full sleeves their whole life and never show off their skin? And if it's on your hands or your face, that's just not possible. So the short answer is the law doesn't yet have clear remedies on that, but I would imagine they would ask you to stop commercializing it.
Mm-hmm. So if you want to sum up this episode, you wouldn't download a tattoo. But, Melanie, thank you very much for coming on the show.
We're going to do an episode about that in future, because there are awful startups who are trying to engage in this question in a much more cynical way and go, oh, there's a money-making opportunity here. Actually, I saw...
If you're going to do that, NFTs and tattoos is interesting as well.
There is this company, and this is probably a good place to finish up. There is this company who Tom's talked about in other podcasts, whose entire business model is, we will license work from the creators of those works so that you can go to get a robot to tattoo it for you perfectly, and the creator of the design will get paid. And they were Instagram posting about that like yesterday. It's their whole business model is, we will produce these robots that will tattoo you with a set of designs which are licensed from the creators, and who get paid a cut of the designs. So there is a very, very cynical part of like venture capitalist America who sees this as an opportunity.
That's very, very interesting. There's something similar for Banksy. So there was a big Banksy graffiti case recently. Sorry, I know we're wrapping up, not to diverge us out, but it turns out a lot of the big kind of high profile graffiti artists have licensed their images to this third party company. I can't remember their name. They're based in the UK, I think. And they then license them on for like artworks or reproductions. So it's quite an interesting thing to see that obviously this company is using a similar model. The litigation and the potential risk on that sounds insane. So I would love to see those contracts.
But very, very classic end of episode reemergence from Matt. Melanie, where can people find you online and read your stuff? Where can people learn more about the law?
Oh, gosh. Well, I do have a Twitter, which is at Mel Copyright. Been fairly inactive for a while, but need to bring that back to life, revive that. But what I would say is, if you're interested, read these cases. There are great articles online. You don't need to go to court judgments. Doesn't need to be majorly in depth. And listen to podcasts like this. I think that's where you get the best information, genuinely.
Best information comes from this podcast. Melanie, thank you so much for coming on the show. And also, as always, we have to give a shout out to £10 and above patrons. This is on the £5 and above feed. But thank you to Stephen McCann, Roy Hoxema, Morpheus Ravenna, Chris Block, Charlie Lightning, Bob of Extra, Shit Jesus, Reed Forden, Lupe Calderon, Garnica, Kirsten Wright, Kathleen Burkhardt, James Schick, and Dylan. Thank you to all of you. As always, housekeeping. Brighton Tattoo Convention, 24th and 25th of February. We will be there with lots of cool stuff for you to buy. We have limited edition posters printed by DB Cooper Prints. We have Matt, can we talk about the bootleg? Maybe not mention it on the show.
Yeah, we can. Yeah, we can do that. Yeah.
Okay. We will also
we're with a copyright lawyer. It's fine.
Yeah. We have a book that we have assembled, which is not 100% one-to-one, but a very close replica of Jesse Knight's Best Of book. We'll have very, very limited copies of that available at Brighton. It's limited to 20 editions. We have the poster by Daz is a rendition of It's Ed Hardy's World, We're All Just Living In It, also limited to 20 copies. We will have shirts, and we will also have Brighton's own Sammy Hellride tattooing from Jesse's Best Of book.
Yes. I should also say, before we finish, because Melanie was too polite to mention it, she does have an open access article that came out recently on this topic called Inking Cultures, Authorship, AI-Generated Art and Copyright Law in Tattooing. If you go on Google Scholar and search Melanie Stockton Brown tattooing, it's open access. You can read her amazing article.
Thank you, Matt. That's kind. And you'll be one of the first readers to read it if you do. So that'll be lovely.
Okay. It's a thank you from me, and bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you.